Welcome back to the program. I'm very pleased to welcome D.R. Tucker, my co-host, when he can join us to this segment. And most of all, very pleased and honored to have Elizabeth Culbert joining us. She, of course, is the exceptional journalist writing on environmental topics mostly. She is a staff writer at The New Yorker. She has written three books, most famously Field Notes from a Catastrophe back in 2006. And I believe it was shortly after that that you were on our program when it was EcoTalk on Air America. If I can call you Betsy, since I know that's what they call you. And
yes, good,
that's
Betsy,
a familiar name to me, even though I'm not an Elizabeth. Great to have you on. This latest book is getting a lot of attention, as it should. I saw you on Jon Stewart. You know, who ever thought that extinction could be funny? But we try to have, you know, a lighter point of view whenever possible so the stuff doesn't get too heavy. He certainly had some good lines for you. Was that a fun experience?
Yeah, it was actually surprisingly fun, considering it's pretty nerve-wracking.
I think it was he who said, you know, where the asteroid this time. And I should mention that I think it was just about 15 minutes ago that we were supposed to have an asteroid pass around, come as close as it's going to come to Earth. So I guess we've ducked that bullet, so to speak.
Yes,
now we just need to worry about us,
human-invasive species.
Little ones
are little meteorites. It's just this matter of size, I suppose. Little ones are very common. Big ones, not so much.
And short of that, we have a lot to worry about. We are quickly taking over the development of the planet, we human beings, and we here in America certainly have a very heavy ecological footprint. The sixth extinction is sort of the other big one that has not really been talked about, the giant green elephant in the room, climate change now finally getting more attention and coverage, but, you know, I'm sure you would agree, years too late. Why is the extinction such a big story that it's almost hard to see?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, it really is the totality of everything that we're doing to the planet. And it turns out that there are many ways, not just climate change, but many ways in which we're changing the planet on really what would be called a geological scale. So 100 million years from now, these changes, very rapid changes not unlike those, you know, precipitated by an asteroid impact, will be visible to the geologists of the future, whoever or whatever they might be. So climate change is one. We're adding a lot of CO2 to the atmosphere. We're doing it very, very rapidly. We're changing the chemistry of the oceans. That has the same cause, a different effect. You add CO2 to the air. You also are adding it to the oceans, and that has the effect of acidifying the oceans. I'm sure many of your listeners have heard the phrase ocean acidification. That has tremendous potential impacts on all sorts of marine life, especially anything that builds a shell.
We talk about that all the time, yes.
Yes, like a skeleton, external skeleton, like corals. We're moving things around the planet. I mean, we don't even think about these things, right? They don't seem significant to us, but then when you think about them in the whole course of the Earth's history, of life's history, it's very difficult for an organism, you know, that's a land organism, to cross an ocean, and it's very difficult for a marine organism to get into to cross a continent. But we do that sort of thing all the time, and often those interactions between species that have been separated by oceans or continents are very, very deadly for one species or another. So that's another way that we are having really permanent impacts, really permanently affecting, you know, sort of the course of evolution here.
And I know DR wants to jump in, but I just have to ask.
Yes, jump in.
I just want to, I mean, you can answer this and maybe in answering his next question as well, but I just wonder, you know, is the issue primarily that nature can't adapt, but things are changing, we are changing things so quickly that nature can't possibly catch up or have a chance of escaping some of the, you know, threats?
Yes, I mean, I think clearly nature is very resilient. Otherwise, you know, there wouldn't be millions of species on the planet. But one of the points of my book, and it's called The Sixth Extinction, because there have been five of these major mass extinctions previously in the last half billion years or so, is that things can be stretched to a breaking point, and there seem to be, you know, synergies and cascading effects when that happens, that the whole ecosystems break down. And, you know, where you reach that point, when you reach that point, is a very, very serious question. That, you know, you can't, it's very difficult to answer when you're in the process of doing it, but scientists who look back at these moments and look back at, you know, what precipitated them are pretty convinced that the changes that we are affecting are, you know, on a scale with some of the great extinctions of the past, and that's especially true, for example, of how much CO2 we're putting into the air and how fast. And so, yes, I think speed is a really, really major component. Evolution is very, very slow, but extinction, it turns out, can be very, very rapid.
Elizabeth, can you tell us a bit about the Red List of Endangered Species that was compiled by the International Union for the Conservation of Nature?
Yeah, the Red List is just, as you say, it's a compilation of what we know about the status of different species, and it goes from, I think, least concern is the phrase used for species that seem to be doing just fine, to then we get to critically endangered, you know, before we get to extinct in the wild. Some species are kept alive, you know, in tanks and things like that, but they're now extinct in the wild. There are increasing number of species like that, or simply extinct. They just don't exist anywhere anymore. And there are all sorts of gradations along the way, and there are criteria, you know, how rapidly is the population, does the population seem to be declining, you know, how big is it to begin with, et cetera, and I don't want to claim to be an expert in exactly how they do those determinations. But, you know, for the vast majority of species on the planet, and I should point out, we do not know how many species there are on the planet within, you know, many, many, you know, even within potentially an order of magnitude, we don't know, are not classified. So there's only certain groups where the Red List is really, you could say, okay, that really covers the whole group. For example, mammals are probably a very well-studied group. We probably know the conservation status of most mammals.
And while this may be an obvious question, why should, you know, our listeners or the average American be concerned about this? Why is this not just another phenomenon that's, you know, inevitable? We should, you know, just continue on our way and hope for the best.
Well, I'm often asked that, and I sort of have two answers, and they're not different answers, but they are intellectually somewhat different. And one is that, you know, we're talking about the spectacular beauty and variety of planet Earth, of life on Earth. It took tens of millions of years to get to the point that it's at now, and we are unraveling that very, very fast. And if you don't care about that, if you don't care about, you know, life on Earth, I'm sort of not sure, you know, what you'd care about. But another sort of, you know, if that still doesn't get you, you know, another sort of more practical concern, I guess, for, you know, ourselves, our kids, et cetera, is, you know, on down, is that these moments of mass extinction appear to be moments, and I quote a British paleontologist who says, these are moments when the rules of the survival game change. So we're changing the rules of the survival game. One of the lessons of the events of the past is that very, very dominant groups of organisms can disappear. There's no guarantee, you know, past performance does not guarantee future success. And so, you know, we're now the dominant creature on Earth. Everything seems to be sort of in our favor, and maybe even it is. We can't say, but if you're changing the rules, you just don't know where the game is going to end.
There was a great review of your book by our friend Wynne Stevenson in the Boston Globe about a week or so ago, and he talked about, you know, how fascinated he was by your description of, you know, what humanity has done and whether humanity will stop doing what it's doing. Do you think it's fair to say that the ultimate question your book asks is whether humanity is fundamentally selfish or not?
Well, I tried to sort of get around the question of good and bad. I think humans are human, and that's very, very interesting. And many of our good qualities also turn out to be pretty dangerous for other species. And those include, you know, the fact that we're extremely cooperative. We have these huge societies, you know, millions of people living in, you know, one society, which other organisms, except really ants, don't really have. So I guess you could say some social insects. We pass down knowledge. So if we innovate, we don't lose that innovation. We pass it down, and other generations build on it. That's why we have these incredible technologies and also these incredible societies. So those are our good qualities, you know. and they. But when you think about it from the perspective of a frog, let's say, or a tree, you know, those aren't necessarily happy things. So I don't know that I can just attribute the problem, the situation that we find ourselves in, just to selfishness, because it's actually, it seems to me, to be honest, even more profound than that.
That was a great article that Wen wrote. You talk about how ocean acidification, as you mentioned, is the big nasty one that's coming down, and how our capacity to change the world is also the capacity to destroy it and ourselves at the same time. Do you think, and even since you know, we last chatted, I think it was 2007 or so, why are Americans seemingly pretty clueless about how we are symbiotic with nature, and this is our life support system that we are blithely experimenting with?
Yeah, I don't know that I have a great answer for that. I think that one of the things that's happened is more and more of us live in places where, you know, if you live in Manhattan or L.A. or Chicago, very, very little of the natural world, you know, what we'd call the natural world, is left. Every tree has been planted. You know, most of the native species are absent, probably, and those that are around are, you know, coming up between the cracks of some sidewalk. And so we don't see any problem with doing that. We're, you know, there's millions and millions of people in there, and they're doing fine. And all that is true. You know, that is absolutely true. The question is, or one question is, you know, at what point do all of the biological systems, which we are still dependent on them, even though, you know, very few of us are farming and very few of us are going to fetch our own water, we're still dependent on these natural systems, the hydrological, you know, system, the nitrogen cycle. When you mess around with them, you know, is there a point at which your own support systems, which we are still reliant on, even though we don't see them and are not in direct contact with them necessarily, do they eventually start to break down? And I don't know the answer to that, but it's certainly not something you'd want to be mucking around with.
Good, thanks. DR, one last question.
Sure. Will you consider sending a copy of this book to Secretary of State John Kerry and President Obama with a nice little note urging both men to read it before they make their final decision on the Keystone Pipeline?
Yes, I think that's a great idea.
I'm
not sure how you get through their handlers, but that's a good idea. Yeah.
I can help you with that, actually.
Okay, please do, yeah.
I went to a conference that you should have been at the White House last May. They had a women's conference summit on energy and climate change.
Oh, really?
I think they're going to do a follow-up this May. They said they were, so I'll make sure you're on that list. You should be speaking there, of course. So we are just about out of time, Betsy. I just want to thank you, Betsy, a.k.a. Elizabeth Colbert, for your, you know, latest contribution. It is so important, and one of the quotes I love from you is that you hope that your readers will appreciate the truly extraordinary moment in which we live. Could not agree more, and the only thing that's more extraordinary than that would be not recognizing the truly extraordinary moment in which we live. We're at the crossroads.
Sleepwalking through history, as we say, yeah.
Yeah, we need to wake up and smell the carbon. That's our battle cry here. And, you know, all the extreme weather shows that we can't, you know, delay doing anything because it's already here much faster than even the climate scientists had predicted.
Yes, a lot of the predictions, I mean, I'd say that the book has held up pretty well, you know, my 2006 book on climate change, but if any of the predictions have not held up, it's because things are moving even faster than they predicted. You're absolutely right.
Agreed. As someone who keeps trying to write a book on all the environmental challenges and can't keep up with the amount of damage going on, I'm just waiting until it's going to be a digital version that can constantly be updated. But in the meantime, you have made the biggest contributions to our green literature with your books, first the iconic Field Notes from a Catastrophe, and now the Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. I love that tagline because, you know, when people talk about weather as a natural event, not anymore.
Yeah.
Not anymore.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, and I really enjoyed your being with us, and really, I would urge people to go check out the interview you did with John Stewart. It's pretty funny, and I guarantee you'll laugh out loud, and that's a tribute to you. So thanks for having humor in spite of the darkness. We try to do that, too, light the way with some, you know, levity when we can, because there is an absurdity factor, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely.
But we're still not quite getting. Well, that does it for this edition of the program. If you miss part of it, I know you'll want to catch the entire interview with Elizabeth Colbert in the second half, and then the first half with Lou Alstadt, the former vice president of Exxon and later ExxonMobil. And that was a very enlightening glimpse into what it's like to be inside the giant oil companies and then to have a bit of an eco-epiphany and turn into an activist against fracking and natural gas drilling, among other interesting aspects of that position that he has held and then what he is taking on now. So the archives can be found at thegreenfront.com. We are going to be wrapping up our show the end of March. It's been 10 years. I've been doing environmental topics, interviews with the leading thinkers, and I hope you'll agree that we get the most interesting and important stories and guests on, and I think it's time to do the next thing, whether that's writing a book or speaking about this. So hope you'll tell your friends about the show. We're going to make sure that the next few shows are especially exciting. And then, of course, the archives will be there for a long, long time. That's thegreenfront.com. So thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.